You're listening to Theology and Apologetics with Thomas Fretwell, bringing theology to life.
So if you remember, we've gone through everything, all this history that led up to this time where the Son of God will arrive on this earth. Remember, Paul referred to it as the fullness of time, the set time, the appointed time, everything carefully arranged in world history for that momentous event when Jesus would be born into this earth. And we're going to look at that more now as we study what we've called the pedigree or the lineage, the genealogy of the Messiah. And it's quite interesting. Now, genealogies. Do we enjoy them or do we not enjoy them? They're not your common devotional read. Basically, they're a long list of names that are quite hard to pronounce and you don't know if you're doing it right. I actually have a Messianic Bible where they put all of the names in Hebrew. And it was quite fun. I did practice reading it. I was going to give it a go, but I changed because it actually ended up taking up like 12 minutes of the whole sermon to do in the whole thing. So I won't do that, but it's good fun to do. But we're going to actually try and make it a little bit more. We're going to go behind what we would just do in devotional reading and try and study the purpose of why these are in here, because we often don't spend the time looking at genealogies, but they are, in fact, quite important for the narrative that we're going to see. And hopefully some of the groundwork that we've already laid will explain that to us. But let's just look broadly for a moment. Why do we have genealogies? Not just Bible genealogies, general genealogies. They are to really show someone's lineage. But one thing that does is it roots that person in real history. Okay, you don't have genealogies really for people who are myths or mythological or anything like that. So this is one thing that we can immediately say is a blessing when we look at these genealogies. And I went on quite a diversion, actually ended up taking way more of my study time than I anticipated, but it was fun because I was looking at the genealogy of Jesus Christ with that in mind. He was a real person who lived, and you can look at how many people in his genealogy can we actually confirm archaeologically outside of the Bible? Because that's quite an interesting question, because we're not just talking about kings and queens of England here or kings and queens of some great empire. We're talking about people who are actually in the genealogy of the Messiah. And you can actually confirm archaeologically 6 different kings within the genealogy of Jesus Christ. Now, it might not sound like a lot, but archaeologically speaking, that's insane. Like that's a huge amount of people in one genealogy to be able to confirm. And they're not just the trivial people. They're pretty crucial people. The main character, theologically, in Matthew's genealogy is King David. And we'll come back to that. Look at verse 6. So you're going to need, as we go through this study, Matthew chapter 1 open, and you're going to need Luke chapter 3 open. Keep your fingers in both of them. I will try and put the relevant scriptures up on the screen. Like I said, we're not just going to read 2 whole genealogies. I'm going to pick out the bits that have got the interesting points for you. So you're going to need to all stay with me because we're going to go behind the scenes, hopefully, and have a look at why we have these genealogies here. So Jesse was the father of David the king, and David was the father of Solomon by Bathsheba, who had been the wife of Uriah. So we'll talk more about David in a minute, but firstly, he's the most important person because Messiah had to be a descendant of King David. Obviously, that was part of one of the qualifications to be the Messiah. And we actually have at least 3 archaeological inscriptions now that indicate King David, that mention King David as a real person. One, different steles and things from Assyrian Empire and stuff like that mention him. And that's fascinating. Also, Uzziah, let me read to you this. I don't know if you can read that. Let's read the whole thing. We will do some of these names. Asa was the father of Jehoshaphat. Jehoshaphat the father of Joram. Joram the father of Uzziah. Uzziah was the father of Jotham, the father of Ahaz. Ahaz the father of Hezekiah. Hezekiah was the father of Manasseh. Manasseh the father of Ammon. Ammon the father of Josiah. Josiah became the father of Jeconiah and his brothers at the time of the deportation to Babylon. So Jeconiah is important. We'll come back to him. But you have Uzziah, Ahaz, Hezekiah, and Manasseh mentioned, all quite crucial kings to the narrative of the Bible there. There's a lot about them, for good and for evil. We can also archaeologically confirm all of those kings through writings of the ancient Near East, cuneiform tablets and things like that. That is also quite amazing. Six historical kings of Judah who are actually included in the lineage of the Messiah. Again, like I said, rooting this in real history in this world. So any of these Jesus mythicists or people like that have real trouble engaging with this sort of data. This is the idea. And there are other people associated with these kings that we can also confirm, but we won't digress into that now. But that is huge anyway. So that's just one thing that is worth noting about genealogies. They do root us into real history. Now, another thing that is not typical for genealogies, but we do find it in Matthew's, is that he has the inclusion of four different women in his genealogy. Now, I say it's not usual because the Jewish tradition was that they always used the male name and they just came down through the male line. That was just how it was done in those days. But Matthew here breaks tradition and he includes, let's read it, verse 2, a number of different people. Abraham was the father of Isaac, Isaac the father of Jacob, Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers. Judah was the father of Perez and Zerah by Tamar. Perez was the father of, notice how it changes there. It doesn't just say the father of so-and-so, it says by Tamar. So he makes an inclusion into this otherwise straightforward genealogy of Tamar there. Perez was the father of Hezron, Hezron the father of Ram. Ram was the father of Amminadab, Amminadab the father of Nashon, Nashon the father of Salmon, Salmon was the father of Boaz, and we see it again here, by Rahab. Boaz was the father of Obed by Ruth, and Obed the father of Jesse, Jesse was the father of King David, and David was the father of Solomon by Bathsheba. So we have Tamar, Rahab, Ruth, and Bathsheba all mentioned here in this genealogy, and they all stand out actually for a number of reasons in this genealogy. Firstly, because that was not the traditional way that you would do it. It almost seemed like the Holy Spirit wanted to include these women for a particular purpose in this genealogy. And that is quite interesting to look at because in many ways, when you see the name, I think the idea is you're supposed to relate it to the story of the narrative that we find in the Old Testament, as in what was particular about these women. And you'll find that all of the stories are a dramatic display of the grace of God in the fact that they ended up in the genealogy of Messiah. Because if you think, they give a good cross-section of the world, the stories that we find. Tamar's story is not a fun one to read in the Bible. She was forced in many ways into deceit and sexual sin, and that was the story there. It also indicts all the men in that story too, particularly her father, and it just reminds us that the world is very, very sinful. The world is broken in that regard. That's Tamar's story. Rahab, she's known as Rahab the harlot. She was a Canaanite prostitute. Yet we also see that she was the one that lied in order to save Joshua and his men when they came to spy out Jericho. So it's again, we see this sort of brokenness going on here in the world. Ruth, everyone knows the story of Ruth, probably one of the nicest episodes in the Old Testament. But Ruth herself was a Moabitess. Now the Moabites and the Ammonites were born out of an incestuous relationship. That whole nation came from that relationship right at the early time of history. So again, in that sense, just a reminder of the sinful world. But at the same time, she became the great-grandmother of King David. So we see that being included in there too. And then Bathsheba, again, the story is one of adultery, of the abuse of power, of sin, of murder, of deceit for both men involved, women, David, everyone's. No one does well in those stories. And this is, again, just reminding us. So you might think, we read this and we think, well, why are we being reminded of all these sorts of things when we're talking about the Messiah, when we're talking about the lineage of the Messiah? And I think it's a reminder of what Jesus came to do to this earth. It doesn't really matter what your background is, what your sins are, what broken situation the world has thrust upon you and that you've had to deal with. The good news is that God does redeem, restore, and ultimately his grace and his plan will triumph. It was through all of those events still that he ended up having the perfect time, the appointed time for when the Messiah would arrive on this earth. And it reminds us again that the story is very much about Jesus, not so much about the people that we might want to elevate, the saints that we might want to elevate throughout the Bible. However, there is one more woman mentioned in the genealogy, of course. Jacob was the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, by whom Jesus was born, who is called the Messiah in Matthew there, verse 16. Mary, of course, we see coming through a woman. It was actually through the woman that all the fulfillment of all the promises would be fulfilled. She gave birth to the Messiah. We'll look at that more as we go through in the coming weeks. However, we can also talk about the men. The genealogies are filled with saints and sinners, if I could put it like that. You have good kings, Josiah, Hezekiah, and then you have some of the most wicked kings in this genealogy too, Manasseh. He was evil above all else, but yet he is still there. So standing back again, it does just show us a number of things. The global reach and scope of the ministry of Jesus Christ almost prefigured in his prehistory, in his genealogical line. The Messiah would be for both Jew and Gentile. One thing about all those women that were mentioned, none of them were Jewish. They were all Gentiles, but yet they all ended up in the line of Messiah. That's quite amazing. The Messiah would be for both male and female. The Messiah would be for both saint and sinner, if I could phrase it like that. Out of all of that darkness, that sin, that brokenness, God brought about the most amazing thing, as we said last week, the indescribable gift that was given to us in the Messiah. It's like a summary message of everything that he would do after he came to this earth, but yet prefigured in the line that would actually bring him to this earth. So that's the observations. Now let's talk about the fact we have two different genealogies. The one in Matthew is different to the one in Luke, and we'll need to dig into this a little bit. They appear at different places in the narrative. If you look at the Gospel of Matthew, he opens with it. Matthew chapter 1, it's the very first thing he does is give this genealogy. Whereas in the Gospel of Luke, he doesn't bring it until Luke chapter 3. He decides to go through the whole story of Christmas, the whole virgin birth and the whole arrival of Messiah. In fact, he takes it up to the baptism of Messiah before he feels it necessary to put the genealogy in there. Look at the difference of how they begin. Matthew 1:1. The record of the genealogy of Jesus the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Now this is significant. Again, remember, every word is significant in the Bible. Remember our study a few weeks back when we looked at the unique purposes of each gospel. We noted how the material selected for each gospel would fit that purpose. What was the purpose of the Gospel of Matthew? It was to present Jesus as the King of the Jews, the King of the Jews. So it's really no mistake that straight off the bat, he connects the Messiah to two of the most pivotal figures in Jewish history, King David and Abraham, of course, Abraham being the father of the Jewish people himself. But the real thing is the covenants that are connected to these two people. That's the thing that's going on behind the text. He associates and puts the record of the genealogy of the Messiah connected to both Abraham and David because of the covenantal promises. Remember, he's showing that Jesus fulfills these promises. What were these promises? Do you remember the covenant with Abraham? Genesis chapter 12, verse 3. I will bless those who bless you, curse those who curse you, and in you all the families of the earth will be blessed. That's the one, the seed of the woman there, that all the families of the earth will be blessed. Jesus is the Messiah, and he is the one who will fulfill that promise. Through him, all the families of the earth will be blessed. And then what about David? David was given a covenant that we call the Davidic covenant. This is the promise that was made to King David that there would always be a seed to rule on his throne, that he would have an eternal throne, eternal house, and an eternal dynasty. And we see this in 2 Samuel 7. I'll read it to you, you don't need to turn there. 2 Samuel 7, the final bit, verse 16 and 17, it says, "Your house and your kingdom," so that's his dynasty, his kingdom, "shall endure before me forever. Your throne shall be established forever in accordance with all these words and all this vision. So Nathan spoke to David. And in a parallel passage, it says, "You will never lack a man to sit on your throne." And the point being, because Jesus is eternal and he came all those years ago, even though there's no throne of David operating today, he fulfills that because he is the man who is ready to take that throne at the right time. The house, the kingdom. This is what was promised to David. And this was something that was at the forefront of the Jewish mind when they were waiting for the Messiah. It was the kingly aspect, which is why the whole Gospel of Matthew is framed around the narrative of the king, the coming king, offering his kingdom, the kingdom being rejected. We'll explore all that as we go through. So that was Matthew's. But what about Luke? Luke starts very differently. Luke starts like this. Luke chapter 3, verse 23. When he began his ministry, Jesus himself was about 30 years of age, being, as was supposed, the son of Joseph, the son of Eli, or Eli. Most people presume 30, that was the age when priests in the Old Testament began their priestly ministry. Most people assume that's why it says here he was about 30, because he's now stepping into the role that Jesus had, preparing to offer that high priestly sacrifice of himself there. That's the idea. And then Luke, if you trace his genealogy back, he proceeds to go all the way back to David. And then he also goes back to Abraham. But then, unlike Matthew, he goes all the way back from Abraham. So before the Jewish people were called out, he goes all the way back to Adam. And if you remember, this fits the purpose of Luke's gospel. Luke's gospel was to show that Jesus is the Son of Man. It focuses on his humanity in general, not just his Jewishness. So this is why that genealogy goes all the way back to Adam, is related to humanity as a whole. But let's dig in a little bit further. Both genealogies show that Jesus was a descendant of David. Okay, so you'll need to stay with me here. So why do we have two genealogies? If the real thing was about actually being a descendant of David, and both genealogies show that he was a descendant of David, why do we have two? Now, the most common answer that you'll get, that'll be in 90% of your commentaries, will go something like this. Matthew's genealogy was to show that Joseph was of the royal line, that he was here, and then Jesus, as his adopted son, had the legal right to take the throne. That's usually how that is explained. And then in the other genealogy, it's shown that he himself was a descendant of David. So he has both the actual biological right, but also the royal right, the legal right. And that's usually how it's left. It's never really explored in huge amounts of depth. Now, I'm going to give you a different view for that. And I'm not saying I'm absolutely right on this. I'm just saying this is a different view that I think is much more appealing, because that one still leaves a few questions up in the air. Why do we have these two genealogies? So I would say the actual point of the Matthew genealogy is completely the opposite of that. It's actually to show that he could not have the legal right to the throne from Joseph. And let me demonstrate that as we go through and show you. You see, the Matthew genealogy, if you turn there, let's go to Matthew genealogy for a moment. You see, historically, to be a king, to be Davidic king, you had to obviously be from the royal line of David if you wanted to take the throne in Jerusalem. And that is true. That was the only qualification, really, at that one stage in Israel's history. However, during a particularly bad period of Israel's history, there was a king who was so bad that God, in fact, put like a curse on him, basically. He restricted the qualifications for kingship. So let's read it in Jeremiah chapter 22, please. Jeremiah 22, I haven't got the slides for this, so. And I'll explain it to you afterwards, but this is just, I want you to see what is going on here. And now, all of this might sound like, why are we looking into all of these old relationships between these people? Ultimately, because we're doing what the genealogies are supposed to do and affirming the right of Messiah to the throne. That is what they are trying to do, but in a different way. Jeremiah 22, verse 24. As I live, declares the Lord, even though Coniah, or your Bible might say Jeconiah, that's the long name and the short name, same person, the son of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, wear a signet ring on my right hand, yet I would pull you off, and I will give you over into the hand of those who are seeking your life, yes, into the hand of those whom you dread, even into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and into the hand of the Chaldeans. I will hurl you and your mother who bore you into another country where you were not born, and there you will die. But as for the land to which they desire to return, they will not return to it. Is this man, Coniah, a despised shattered jar, or is he an undesirable vessel? Why have he and his descendants been hurled out and cast into a land that had not known? O land, land, hear the word of the Lord. Thus says the Lord, write this man down childless. Focus on this bit. A man who will not prosper in his days, for no man of his descendants will prosper sitting on the throne of David or ruling again in Judah. This king of Judah, Jeconiah, was so evil that the Lord said, you're going to get taken to captivity in Babylon and none of your descendants will ever rule on the throne of David again. So whereas now the qualification had been, you only had to be a descendant of David, now, after this episode, you had to be a descendant of David, but not of the house of Jeconiah. So it's a further restriction on who could rightfully rule the throne. Everyone with me? Okay, that's important to know. It's a big episode. And in Jewish thought, this was a massive point. There's huge amounts of Talmudic writings about the curse of Jeconiah. And so I want you to remember, we're trying to get back into the mindset of the Jewish people in Matthew's gospel that Jesus is writing to. This would have been an issue. You present someone as the king, you need to find out whether he's related to Jeconiah, whether it's an actual rightful ascent to the throne. So, back to the two genealogies. Look at verse 6 in Matthew. Jesse was the father of David the king. David was the father of Solomon by Bathsheba, who had been the wife of Uriah. And Solomon was the father of Rehoboam, the father of Abijah, and Abijah the father of Asa. So Joseph was a descendant of David through David's son Solomon. And then verse 10, we won't read again, we'll skip certain bits, but verse 10, Hezekiah was the father of Manasseh, Manasseh the father of Ammon, Ammon the father of Josiah, and then look, Josiah became the father of who? Jeconiah and his brothers at the time of the deportation to Babylon. And after the deportation to Babylon, Jeconiah became the father of Shealtiel. So Joseph's lineage that we're seeing here, he was a descendant of David, but he was also a descendant of Jeconiah, which actually means he could not pass on and he had no legal right to the throne because that line had been said, you'll never rule on the throne. So the argument that says Matthew's genealogy was to show the legal right to the throne, it's actually the exact opposite. Matthew's genealogy is to show that he could not have the legal right to the throne. Because many people, of course, didn't know the virgin birth and all these different things. They would have seen Joseph as the parents, and they would have said, got to go through the father, but he's disqualified. He can't be the Messiah in that respect. This is the stuff that's going on in their head. What Matthew is in fact doing is presenting the Jeconiah problem straight away. Like Joseph was a descendant of Jeconiah. He needs to deal with that straight away if the Messiah is going to come or be. He's going to be the adopted parent of the Messiah. And how does he do that? Obviously, he does it, we know the story, with the virgin birth. That is how he solves that problem. See, this is really what is going on in the background to the Matthew issue. So Matthew is immediately presenting this problem, and he's immediately solving it with the virgin birth. Jesus was not Joseph's biological son, and thus there was no Jeconiah problem. Verse 16 makes this very clear. Jacob was the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, by whom Jesus was born, who was called the Messiah. And the word whom there, in my Bibles, in Greek, that is a singular and it is feminine. And it is the idea is to emphasize that it was through Mary alone that the Messiah came into the world, i.e. Joseph's biological lineage through Jeconiah, disqualification, had absolutely nothing to do with it. So he's presenting this to the Jewish people, the problem and the solution all in one genealogy, okay? Everyone get that? It is important to show why he's got this in here. I know it's maybe not the most thrilling thing, but like I said, big picture here, we're doing the whole study of the Gospels. We want to look at all these little things. So that is Matthew's genealogy. Now let's switch gears. That kind of understands a little bit of that. Now let's go to Luke. You see, Luke doesn't address this problem, the Jeconiah problem at all. Remember, Luke's writing to a much wider audience. Many people wouldn't have been thinking about these sorts of intricacies of Jewish history. However, Luke is, remember, he was a very good historian. He researched everything. Luke sticks to the strict tradition of how you write a genealogy. Okay, so he has no women's names in there. He doesn't skip generations like we actually find Matthew does do that a little bit. And this creates a bit of a problem. You see, most people look at the genealogies, and if you go on Bible mistake websites, those critical atheist websites, show me all these mistakes in the Bible, this is one that they often say. They'll look at Matthew, and they'll read this. Jacob was the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, by whom Jesus was born. Jacob was the father of Joseph. Okay, that's what Matthew says. But then Luke seems to imply that someone else was the father of Joseph. He says, when he began his ministry, Jesus himself was about 30 years of age, being, as was supposed, the son of Joseph, the son of Eli. So that's the question. Is Joseph the son of Jacob or is he the son of Eli? The genealogies seem to say both. They can't both be right. That's a problem. And critics make a big deal of this. But as always, the problem is 21st century critics applying misunderstanding standards of ancient history of the way we do things. Now, the answer to this problem and the reason for Luke's genealogy is basically that it's not Joseph's genealogy. Although it says Joseph there, it's actually Mary's genealogy that we're being given here. Now, the Jewish tradition was that you would use the male names, okay? But that gives us a problem. If you had to use the male names, what do you do if you want to actually do a female line? If you want to show the lineage of a female, how do you do it? The Jewish law had a way that they dealt with this. They specified that in that situation, you would just use the name of the husband to start the line off. And then that gives us another problem. If that's the case, how do you know whether the genealogy is the husband or the wife's, if that's what you had to do? So it's kind of problem after problem, but they had solutions for all of these things. Sounds so odd to us, but to them, that was just how they did it. That's what they thought. They were all aware of it, as we will see. Again, it's the English that actually complicates it. And stay with me again here. In Greek, it was much simpler. Now, in English, we don't put definite articles before proper names. I'm not the Tommy or the David or the Joseph or the Abraham, the Mary. It sounds odd. We don't do that. But in Greek, it's totally acceptable to do that. And when you go through Luke's genealogy, there is a definite article in front of every single name, except one name, and that's the name of Joseph at the beginning. Okay, and that would have been the indicator that this was not Joseph's genealogy, it was Mary's. And the text does try to allow for this, because you notice it says, as was supposed, the son of Joseph. That's the indicator. It's like an editorial gloss there that something is different in the Greek. And that was the clue that's what we jump on here. So although Joseph's name is used, he then traces Mary's line just using his name as the filler, which was common practice of what they used to do in those days. That was the Jewish law. Okay? You're never going to want to touch a genealogy again, are you, after this? So, there we go. Hopefully at the end you'll get it. So Luke works back. Okay? So it's Mary's line now. He does work back all the way to David, just the same as the Matthew one did. But notice, remember, as Matthew, tracing Joseph, went through his son Solomon, Mary's genealogy doesn't. Look at verse 30. The son of Simeon, the son of Judah, the son of Joseph, the son of Jonam, the son of Eliakim, the son of Meliah, the son of Menah, the son of Mattatha, the son of Nathan, the son of David. So Mary was a descendant of David through Nathan, not through Solomon, and thus not through Jeconiah at all. So Mary did not have any blood of Jeconiah running through her veins, and therefore there was no problem with the Jeconiah issue there going on. She was a rightful descendant of David, though, and therefore, as she alone was singly responsible for the flesh of the Messiah, for the birth of Jesus Christ in that respect, he too is also a rightful son of David, apart from the line of Jeconiah, and therefore fulfills the qualification where he is the rightful heir to the throne. Okay, now that's a very long way of going through the details to show you that the genealogies are there to show you that he is the rightful heir to the king. But that would have been a question that was on the mind of the people at this time. He was in fact the right person, descendant of David, but not through the disqualified line, and that came through his mother Mary. Okay, you'll be glad there's only two genealogies in the Gospels, and we've done them now. We've done them all. So let's just take a big picture as we step back from this. This is what was going on here. He goes all the way back. Mary had no Jeconiah blood in her veins, and she was the royal descendant. Basically, Messiah through her was the royal descendant. These are not devotional readings, but they are important because they do establish the historical qualifications for the messianic claim. And the Jewish people would have been very interested in that. And in fact, just looking into the research for this, you can go online today. There are, because of the DNA research that we can do now, there's a whole group of people in Israel who are descendants of David also. And there's a whole, they've put together, and the main rabbinic authority over there doesn't like to talk about it because they don't want the Messiah and the David and all this kind of talk of stuff like that. But there's a whole group of them. But of course, they're still looking for Messiah. They don't understand the historical lineage here. But it's quite interesting to look at there still are descendants of David around alive and well today that we can track down now. But we're not looking for another descendant of David. We know that the Messiah, the true king, has already come, and he is the one who will take the throne. So we've seen in these genealogies that Jesus was a real person tied to real earthly history. And this tells us that he can redeem anyone and everything that he chooses to in that respect. He came for mankind, all of mankind. He came for the Jew, for the Gentile, for male, for female, slave and free. He fulfilled both the Abrahamic covenant to bless the whole world. He fulfilled the Davidic covenant to be the rightful king who would eternally rule on an eternal throne over an eternal dynasty over all the earth. He is the rightful king. He is the seed of the woman. We know that he is the Messiah. All of those qualifications he fulfills. And there are many more that we'll see as we go through the Gospels. He had a human ancestry. He had Jewish ancestry. He also had Gentile ancestry. He had a royal ancestry. He had a lowly ancestry. Mary was poor as poor could be in those days. He also had a holy ancestry. His ancestry was imperfect, full of sinners. He was immortal in that sense. Well, he wasn't mortal, but he had a mortal ancestry in that respect. But he also had an immortal ancestry too. We studied that last week. In the beginning was the Word was with God, and the Word was God. All of these things have to be held together, and you only begin to glimpse the pedigree of the one we call Messiah. Amen.
You've been listening to Theology and Apologetics. This podcast is supported by your generous donations. To help us continue to bring you great content, please visit our Patreon site at patreon.com/theologyandapologetics. If you've been blessed by this podcast, please leave us a review and remember to connect with us on social media. For more resources, please go to theologyandapologetics.com. Thanks for listening.